Shortly before the hearing, Kevin Mitnick pled guilty to one count of computer fraud and one burglary count. In exchange for the dismissal of two additional charges, and in the hope of being sentenced to probation instead of a term in the California Youth Authority prison system, Kevin agreed to testify for the prosecution, even if it meant betraying Roscoe. On December 16, 1981, a pretrial hearing was held. The prosecution's first witness was Susan, who cut an imposing figure as she strode to the witness stand and swore to truthfulness. Susan had been given immunity. Under Assistant District Attorney Clifton Garrott's gentle questioning, she recounted Roscoe's trespass into the U.S. leasing system. He had arrived one evening the previous December to take her out on a date, and as she was getting ready, he sat down at her computer terminal and dialed into U.S. leasing. When she asked him what he was doing, Susan told the court, he said that he was using a program called God to get into a privileged account in order to run a program called Money to print out the passwords on the system. Susan went on to explain in detail how the Money program could only be called up using a certain account. Unable to follow the exchange between Garrott and his witnesses, the judge interrupted. "Slow down a minute," he demanded. "This is a whole new education for me over here." The proceeding digressed for a few minutes, while Susan presented an introductory course in computer terminology for the uninitiated in the room. She explained passwords, logins, and account numbers. When Roscoe got the Money program to run, she continued, she saw him start to write down passwords and account numbers. And when she looked at the screen a few minutes later, she recalled, the words delete and zeroed had appeared. At that point, Garrott produced a ragged 8.5 by 11 inch sheet, torn from a 3-ring binder, and held it up for the judge to see. It was the very piece of paper on which Roscoe had jotted down numbers and passwords on the evening in question. He was shocked to see this incriminating evidence in the prosecutor's hands. Garrott continued his questioning. He asked Susan if she had asked Roscoe what he was doing at her terminal. "Yes," she answered. "He said he was taking care of business, getting even." Then she said he began laughing hysterically, crazy-like. At the prosecutor's gentle prodding, she said she was upset by Roscoe's behavior that night. "The vibes weren't right. There was a lot of tension between us," she told the court. "I said, 'Why did you do that? You know it was destructive.'" "What did he say?" asked Garrott. "I got no response." Jose Mariano Castillo, Roscoe's attorney, did his best to discredit Susan as a witness. "When, in December of 1980, did this incident take place?" he asked her. "I believe it was the 12th or 13th. "What day of the week was that?"
"Thursday or Friday."
"Were you employed?"
"Yes."
"Where were you employed?"
"The Leather Castle."
"What was your occupation at the Leather Castle?" Garrott leapt to his feet to object. The question was irrelevant and immaterial. "What is the relevance of the type of work she was doing there?" the judge asked Castillo.
"Well, it goes to credibility, Your Honor."
"How?"
"Well, let me ask her specifically." And he turned back to Susan. "Were you a prostitute?"
"No,"
Susan replied hotly, expressing indignation at the very suggestion. Garrott objected to the question, and the judge sustained his objection. Castillo continued. "Have you ever been prosecuted for prostitution?" This time, Garrott objected before Susan could answer. Try as he might, Castillo could pursue no line of questioning that might help impugn her testimony. Each time Castillo asked a question of Susan, Garrott objected to it as irrelevant. The judge sustained all but a few of the objections. When the prosecutor didn't object, Susan was coy with Castillo, often craning forward and asking him to repeat the question as if she were hard of hearing or confused. Castillo asked her if she had been in love with Roscoe.
"Infatuated, perhaps?" Susan responded. "In love? No."
Castillo asked if Roscoe had been rejecting her advances.
"Yes," was Susan's reply.
"And you felt upset because of the rejection?"
"No, he wasn't the only man I was going out with."
"How many people were you going out with, dating at that time?" This time the judge overruled Garrott's objection and instructed Susan to answer the question.
"3 or 4.
When Castillo began to ask her about her drug problems, Garrott was quick to object again. Castillo persisted. Susan's drug problems, he claimed, had some effect on her emotional state,
Moreover, he said, she had sexual problems. The judge rebuffed him and sustained Garat's objection. The hearing dragged on this way into the afternoon. Every time Castillo tried to impute vengeful motives to Susan, to sully her credibility or introduce other names, Kevin Mitnick, Stephen Rhodes as possible suspects, Garat leapt to his feet and the judge ruled in his favor. All told, Roscoe's prospects were beginning to look bleak. If this pretrial hearing was the legal equivalent of a movie's rough cut, Roscoe could easily imagine how the finished film would turn out. At the end of the afternoon, Kevin was called to testify. He began by explaining the term phone freak to the court. While refraining from placing himself in any category in particular, Kevin described different types of freaks. One type is a person that likes to manipulate telephone lines and computers, he lectured. Another one is the type that just likes talking with other people on conference lines and stuff like that. Kevin recounted the visit to the Cosmos Center in precise detail. The Shakey's meeting, the trashing, the unsuspecting guard, the foraging through room 108, the stealing of the manuals. Garat showed particular interest in what transpired later at Winchell's Donuts. Kevin told the prosecutor that the manuals were left in the cars, but the door code list was brought inside, and that he later made a copy of the door codes for himself. Afterward, Kevin said, he and Roscoe divided up the manuals from behind Kevin's car. Despite his best efforts, Roscoe's attorney wasn't making much headway in building up a convincing case for his client's innocence. Rather than taking the chances with a trial and risk fumbling the defense in court, Roscoe's attorney decided to work out a plea bargain with the prosecutor. On April 2, 1982, a day before his 22nd birthday, Roscoe pled no contest to the conspiracy charge and to the charge of computer fraud against U.S. leasing. 2 months later, he was sentenced to 150 days of work furlough. Ross got 30 days. Kevin had considerably more luck than his confederates. After a 90-day diagnostic study mandated by the juvenile court system, he got a year's probation.